This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Our Jodbite this month is with Emeritus Professor of Astrophysics, Professor Ralph Spencer. Ralph did his BSc in Physics in Birmingham in 1966. He then moved to do an MSc in Radio Astronomy at Manchester in 1968. He stayed there to do his PhD in Cosmic Ray Air Showers. He's been here pretty much ever since. Ralph, what is it about Jodrell Bank that's kept you here for so long?
Oh, gosh. Well, first of all, I think it's one of the most beautiful places to work in the world, really. We're out in the countryside, and a beautiful scenery, nice and peaceful. One can get on with things here, which you couldn't do in the city. And so that, to me, has been a major advantage of working here. It's been pretty stimulating, really, on the work that one can do with... I think with being out in an observatory, I think for me it's made the difference, because you can think about technical things as well as thinking about the astronomy and astrophysics. So I've always been, from a kid, interested in electronics and so on, and being able to apply that and use it for making instruments and so on, I've always found fascinating. But I've also been keen on the astronomy and the physics. So I like to make instruments which I can then use to do some astronomy with. So in other words, I like both aspects, the observational side, as it were, and the technical development side.
What was it like? I mean, you've been here since, 1968, pretty much when pulsars were discovered. What was this site like compared to now, and what was it like to be a student here?
It was, I don't think the site was that different. We've got a lot of new buildings, of course, compared with what we had then. And in those days, we were using all the huts around the green, rather more than we do now. Each individual hut had its own little group, and the group consisted of one or two lecturers and a couple of students, and maybe a postdoc, and that was a group. And we had about half a dozen different groups who were working on various aspects of radio astronomy. There were only 11 academic members of staff in those days. And we just started the new MSc course in 66, it was, where there were, again, 11, but there were 11 students. I'd started that, and I was one of them. It was very different. Of course, it was all run by Sir Bernard Lovell, who was a great man. He ran the place very tightly. you couldn't do exactly as you liked. On the other hand, he did, if you made a case for something, he would back you. Nice. And he would... he himself always looked after all the finances for the whole system. And, of course, it's only in more recent years that we realised really what a major job that was. And when one has to do it oneself in terms of getting grants and so on, you realise how difficult a problem it was for him. But he did it all on his own bat, really.
It was
amazing. So we were free to just get on with research. Didn't have to think about finances.
Well, we've had some fantastic people here, and of course your PhD supervisor was Professor Sir Francis Graham-Smith, who's still here and still in the same research group as you.
Yes, more or less. I mean, I was given a choice, actually, in 1971 of what I would do. I had a careful thought about which of the groups I should join, and one of them was, of course, the pulsar group, but I joined the interferometry group instead, the long baseline interferometry group, because I felt, it was really cosmology and extragalactic radio sources I found more interesting, so I went into that at the time.
How did you live as a PhD student here on site?
Well, I of course was married by then, and so we had a house in Congleton, and I used to commute by car every day, still do.
So you
changed, same roads. But the so we lived away, but we were reasonably sociable. I mean, it was a bit later that the accommodation locally was generated. There was a couple of houses that were used by students, and students often lived locally. When I was first a student, right up until, I think, the 80s, or certainly the late 70s, there was a bus went from Wilmslow every day, and so people used to use the bus regularly. So the staff and students caught the bus, and it would arrive here at 9:30 in the morning and leave here at 6.
Right.
So our regular working hours were always 9:30 till 6 in those days, which suited me. So
I've heard some horror stories about the dormitories we have here on site that are currently disused. You were never subject to
Yes, I've used the dormitories in my time. I've even used them when it was basically bunk beds in a large bunk room.
Right.
And then I've even put up visitors in there, and I actually bought a rug because the lino was so cold. So yeah, it was. Then they were refurbished, and they weren't too bad then. They were reasonable rooms, but I think for anybody to stay any length of time, they must have been very brave.
Yeah, I think nobody knows if they're now, right? We use them to store some magnetic tapes.
Yeah, we store them just for storage. Tapes. Well, they were condemned by the fire department.
Right. Oh, right. I see. Yeah,
Not, the rooms are a bit of a fire trap, so for modern standards, so there's no way we could use it. So we sold the furniture and found a good home for it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So your initial research as an MSc student was on cosmic rays and the detection thereof.
Yes, that's right. It's using radio techniques to detect cosmic rays. Cosmic rays are highly energetic charged particles that hit the Earth's atmosphere, and they cause a cascade of particles. Now, the energy that they're coming at is many, many orders of magnitude higher than even the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider. So they're basically involving interactions which, as of yet, nobody's experimentally been able to reproduce or even to study. So it would, if we could study them properly, push the modern high energy physics to a higher level. So that would be quite interesting. But what we did was to think of ways of detecting them, because they're quite rare. It's one at the higher energies of, say, 10 to the 20 electron volts. It's one per square kilometre per century.
Right.
So they're very low rate. So you need thousands of square kilometres in order to get a sensible rate of detection for the highest energy ones.
So that's per square kilometre.
Per square kilometre.
So if I've got a square kilometre detector,
yeah,
I can expect one count.
You've got to wait
century.
100 years at least, yeah.
Wow. So any appreciable amount, you're going to need a detector effectively that's, well, it's huge.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
or refining technique somehow.
That's right. Now, the Auger array, which is the current large area detector, one of them, that's in South America. That is, I think, about 3,000 kilometres. I forget the exact figure.
Right.
But it's spread over a very large area. The detectors, they don't fill it up with a detector. The detectors are on tanks of water where the charged particles go through and there's a flash of light from a thing called Cherenkov radiation, and you can detect that with a photo detector. But they're spaced every kilometre or so. So there's a small detector spaced out every few hundred metres to a kilometre.
Right,
and so you might have 1,000 of those, and it's spread over a large area.
So what actually? I mean, it's a bit of a misnomer, isn't it, to call it a ray? What actually is a cosmic ray?
It's a charged particle. It's a proton, mostly protons, perhaps heavier elements, up to iron or something like that. But they're relatively rarer. They're mostly protons at these high energy. So they trigger a cascade in the Earth's atmosphere. And that's a cascade of electrons and muons and other charged particles. And they're the things that can be detected by the particle detector.
I see.
But the electrons also have they tend to bunch up in a thing called the shower front, which is only about a metre or so wide. And so you've got lots of highly energetic electrons moving through the Earth's atmosphere. And it was Askarian who thought there may be a charge excess, an excess of electrons over positrons, due to interactions with the Earth's atmosphere. And if there is, then this would act like a giant radiator, and we should be able to detect it in radio waves.
Right.
Waves of wavelength similar to the width of the shower front, that sort of order. And it was John Jelly in Harwell who pushed this idea for using radio techniques back in the 60s, and he encouraged Graham Smith to join in. And when I joined the group here in 66, that work had been running for about a year or so, and I joined the group to work on detecting the radio emission. And we had a small particle detector array, lots of radio aerials of all various kinds in the field. So my first, I was first issued with a pair of gum boots, a pair of Wellingtons, and given a spade and told to dig some post holes. So that was an introduction to radio astronomy, with digging holes in the ground. It was great.
Excellent. Yeah, I was leafing through your thesis last night, actually, from your MSc, and
yeah,
it was all nicely hand typed and
hand
drawn diagrams. Yeah, something we can't really do anymore now. We've got
no. You're not allowed to do it. I'm much sooner to do it that way.
So, How are cosmic rays accelerated to these colossal energies? Ah,
good question. The mechanisms are still, the original so-called Fermi mechanism is still the preferred one, I think, where basically you get a region containing magnetic field or a cloud of magnetic gas that moves into the interstellar medium or somewhere. And if you imagine these clouds are moving around and you're a car, the analogy is if you're riding on the motorway, and if you're you imagine a charged particle being your car, and you don't really want to hit things, do you? But if you're travelling on the same lane as other cars, you're all going at the same speed, and the chance of a collision is fairly low that it does happen. If, on the other hand, you decide to go on the wrong lane, the opposite way, and go against the flow of the traffic, you're going to have a lot of collisions.
Yes.
So, in other words, overtaking collisions are relatively rare, but head-on collisions are common. So if you've got these moving gas clouds, you can work out, as Fermi worked out, that a head-on collision will result in a bounce, if you like, or change in the direction of the charged particle and increase its energy. So overtaking collisions lose energy, and head-on collisions increase the energy of the charged particle. So by this means, through many collisions, he was able to show that you can produce the spectrum of, you know, the rate at which the cosmic rays come versus energy. You can reproduce that by this technique, this mechanism. Other mechanisms involve shock, and that is a similar sort of thing, that the shock seems to overtake the particles, and they go through the shock a few times, and thereby increasing energy. And yet another one, of course, is in your favourite subject, is in pulsars, where there may well be acceleration mechanisms with close to the pulsar, near the pole or whatever, where these things are accelerated. So the mechanisms are actually a little bit unclear still. I think it's still, there are still conferences on accelerating cosmic rays. Their origins are still unclear, particularly at the highest energies. There's some hint that the higher energies that Centaurus A and other extragalactic objects were the source. The problem is, being charged particles, they're bent by magnetic fields in the galaxy and in intergalactic space. So when they arrive, they don't arrive from the original direction. And obviously, the higher the energy, the less they're deflected. But nevertheless, it is an issue in trying to find out what their origins are.
Right. I've read that... Well, it seems that one of your favourite objects, looking through your publication list, Cygnus X-3, is a strong source of cosmic rays.
It was mooted to be, yes. I mean, we don't... I guess we don't really know. There have been papers suggesting that it is... it's an X-ray binary source. It's consisting of possibly a black hole with a close relationship with a star, which almost surrounds it. There is a thick envelope, in other words, around this object, which does affect the radio emission and the optical emission. It's one of the brightest ones optically, and has one of the... Is it? No, it isn't. Sorry, it's very faint. I'm thinking of Cygnus X1. Get them mixed up. Cygnus X3 is not very bright optically. It can be seen in the infrared, but it does mean it's harder to study than some other objects from that point of view. It has a very short orbit, only about 4.8 hours.
Oh, right. Okay.
It was thought at one time you could see that in the radio and even in gamma rays, but I think that's been disputed since.
What are the effects of cosmic rays or their fallout on the Earth or on system? Are there any dangers from impact from cosmic rays?
Well, I think we've lived with them for, you know, several billion years. So you could argue that that's, the cause of... It generates the power of evolution, in a sense, because if it causes mutations, which it would do, over a period of time, that might well result in the way that evolution has worked.
Wow.
There's also natural radioactivity as well, of course. So you can argue, how do mutations come about? How do changes in populations come about? And I suppose cosmic rays could help do that. It's one of those things that may be there.
Yeah.
They're not... In other words, we've lived with them, the use of them. We know our bodies and so on have evolved to be able to cope with them and live with them. If the intensity were to increase by a large factor, then we probably wouldn't. We'd start to kill people. You would get radiation,
yes,
damage, and disease, of course. So, but the highest energy ones are sufficiently rare that that's not really a problem. you're not likely to be hit by a high-energy one. But the low-energy muons, for instance, at lenses of, say, 100 MeV or thereabouts, 100 million electron volts, there's probably about 50 a second going through us. So okay.
Slightly
creepy. We're sat here being radiated.
It's the same thing with neutrinos, isn't it? I heard that
and neutrinos are even more,
thumb,
of course.
Your thumbnail, which is about a square centimetre, there are several billion of them passing through you every second, regardless of the time of day.
Yeah.
Coming from the sun. Coming back to the idea of detectors and interesting detectors and how we can actually see cosmic rays, I've read that you've been working on using the moon as a cosmic ray detector. How does that work?
Well, the interesting thing is, I think it was 10 or 15 years ago, some people in Holland and Germany sort of revived the idea of using radio techniques to detect cosmic rays after being dormant for some years. And with modern techniques, you can now record directly, which we couldn't do in the old days. We had to record everything on film and read it. Now it's all digitized, of course, and you can handle the data better and more accurately. Really, the whole subject is revived, and there is now a major use for the technique, and using things like LOFAR particularly, where not just to study the origins and have a very large collecting area, but you can study where the maximum of the shower is, and this is related to the composition. So it's a way of studying the composition of the cosmic rays at energies of around 10 to the 17, 10 to the 18 electron volts. Now, if you want to use radio techniques, for instance, to get a bigger area and detect the highest energy ones, then you need to spread, obviously, radio aerials over a large area, just like the particle detectors. And so it's an advantage. It's not so obvious. The radio cone, as it were, is not so far different from the particle cone in terms of size distribution on the ground, as it turns out. Now, the thought had been expressed some years ago by Dr. Szymanski in Russia, that maybe this effect of generating radio emission by charged particles passing through matter could be seen on the moon. And he suggested it. And of course the moon is quite a large body, and if you can detect the radio pulses from the moon here on Earth, then the moon itself is acting like a giant detector. That idea has been pushed forward, and a number of experiments have been done trying to detect radio emission from the moon, including one that we did here with a couple of MPhys students, in fact. We had about half a day on the telescope, that's all. But we set an interesting limit, and it's worth doing. So a number of experiments, as I say, have been done, none giving positive detections, because the problem is you're looking for these narrow pulses in a morass of man-made interference. If you switch on a light switch, that generates a narrow pulse, which you can see with this sensitive receiver. So there are lots of man-made and other pulses lying around in the environment, and you need to separate the ones that are actually coming from the moon from ones coming from elsewhere.
How easy is that?
Pretty difficult. You have to have, one thing is to have compare on the moon with off the moon, and looking at, and other anti-coincidence things that look at other things coming in sideways, if you like, and off the axis of the telescope. So, and you have to look carefully at the characteristics of the pulse as well. So there are a number of discriminants, but it's quite difficult.
And of course, the problem only gets worse over time, as we've
said. It does, yeah. But we have a proposal in to use the SKA, and because it's got a very large collecting area, it means that you can detect charged particles at lower energies than you can with a single telescope, small telescope. And of course, it's spread over quite a large area as well, so that will give you perhaps an improved chance of detecting things. So a number of simulations have been done, and the idea is to look at the limb of the moon. It's not the body of the moon, because the interaction length is only a few meters, so it's only in the regolith on the surface of the moon near the limb is where you expect to detect these radio pulses to be generated by charged particles going through the cascade into the rock. So you look with radio emission, and it's at probably microwave frequencies rather than the very low frequencies we use in the early days, because of it's rock and it's a higher refractive index. So the idea is to put lots and lots of beams all around the rim of the moon, and compare with the centre of the moon, and compare with off the moon, and that will help immensely, because then you can see where, because the interference pulse will occur in more than one beam, just as in fast radio burst research, so we eliminate those. Which brings me on to another thing. Fast radio bursts are fascinating objects, but there are other events found which occurred in more than one beam of the telescope, as I was saying. It's, and so they were thought, well, probably not coming from that direction. Perhaps they're local or some sort.
Mm.
Anyway, there was working by the Australians, indicated that it might be due to microwave ovens, which are working in a non-expected way, because the emission was at frequencies out of the range of microwave ovens or anomaly. Anyway, we saw this paper and decided to do a quick test here at Jodrell Bank, where we set up a receiver in front of a microwave oven, and the microwave oven's on, and you just open the door. Now, the power goes off as you open the door, but it takes a little while for the voltages to decay inside the magnetron that's generating the radio emission. And so it decays from its nominal frequency of 2.4 gigahertz, and it sweeps down in the second or so down to, say, 1 gigahertz. So while it's sweeping, it mimics these dispersed pulses that one perhaps sees from fast radio bursts. So there is a nice pulse that comes out and looks exactly like, well, many of the characteristics, not entirely, because its frequency behaviour is not exactly the same.
Mm.
But they shoot across the band in that way. And we saw it on the spectrum analyzer and saw it sweep across and thought, amazing. That was the first experiment I've ever set up and done which worked first time. If anybody's done practical physics, they know you have to work at it to make the darn thing work. And then this thing just
give me an idea of what that setup was. Where were you? Were you outside here with a microwave?
No, we were in the tea room. Our microwave oven here is covered in a large metal box to stop its normal radiation escaping, because of course radio telescopes are very, very sensitive.
Mm.
So we were in the tea room and we put a small horn antenna on the table and had the spectrum analyzer set up just a few feet away from the, and I stood to one side of the microwave oven, opened the door, and off it went. So it was very simple, the way that it was done. We have done a number of further experiments. We deconstructed the microwave oven to see what's inside it. I'm looking at a magnetron from that one right now. It's in the window just here.
Yeah, on the windowsill.
Yeah. And so we can see then by looking at circuit diagrams and so on, see how they work and understood largely what was happening. But we haven't really been able to reproduce these events on the telescope. We tried a little while ago radiating from out in the field onto the telescope. But didn't really see the pulses.
So hang on, did you take a microwave oven out into the field?
Yeah, we had microwave ovens out in the huts and fields and tried a couple of them.
Okay.
And to see.
Are you cooking anything at the time?
You have to load them, so you put a cup of water in.
Okay.
Otherwise,
heavy lunch as part of the experiment.
Otherwise it wouldn't work very well. So anyway, that was an interesting little sideline, but it was good. We had a master student work on it, and he's probably going to talk about it. I'll give a poster anyway at the meeting coming up.
So you say these were potentially mimicking some of the observational properties of fast radio bursts. How do you separate the two?
I think largely it's A, does it obey the 1 over F squared dispersion characteristic? That's one. Does it come in more than one beam of the telescope? Things which are in space are localized and compact and should only appear in one beam of the multi-beam telescope. If they appear in more than one beam, it means that it's something which is probably in the near field of the telescope, which microwave ovens generally are. Near fields mean the telescope no longer acting like you would expect an optical telescope, for instance, to behave. It's very much a property of electromagnetism. So it's sensitive, really, to everything all around it, but nowhere near as sensitive as it would be on axis looking in a distant object. You get a gain of around about unity as opposed to a gain of many millions.
I mean, I've seen what one of these signatures looks like in data. It's this just like little mark in.
Yeah, it's mark on the plot. You just see
space. It's called a periton, apparently, which is a mythical
creature. Mythical beast. It's a cross between an eagle and a horse.
So,
oh, no, an eagle and a stag. That's right. So it's a stag with wings, basically.
Yeah.
And this is a mythical beast, and somebody coined the name periton, a bit of inspired thought. And so everyone's got a mythical beast in their kitchen at home. If you've got a microwave oven, you've got a periton in your kitchen.
Yeah, so every time you put something in, you're creating one of these.
You have. If you open the door too quickly, yes.
Yeah, so I mean, this is a radio quiet site, but this isn't a radio quiet area like Greenbank. So there are houses around here. So are we seeing peritons from people's lunch?
We probably are, yes. Almost certainly, yeah.
And there's no real way. We can't really go around everybody's house.
You can't go around
and
switching everybody off.
No. Their microwave ovens in a Faraday cage.
No. We would recommend always that don't just open the door when it's still cooking. Always finish the cycle. Press the stop button. And then it'll die down naturally, and then you open the door. The radiation that comes out is not dangerous. It was at a few watts. It wasn't at the kilowatts at the, so it's, not to be recommended opening the door all of a sudden. So yeah. I would definitely just let it stop first, always.
It is something I think about now when I open my microwave oven door when I can see something boiling over. It's like, periton. I just made a periton.
Yeah.
It's quite satisfying.
Yeah.
So, well, you, I've done a lot of work on instrumentation here at Jodrell, particularly on interferometry and linking telescopes together. Why are many small telescopes, better than one big telescope?
It's cost. It'd be very nice to have a very large telescope. The reason is you need a large telescope to get the resolving power, the angular resolution that you would need really to study quite compact objects. I mean, a lot of the things are less than something like a half of extragalactic radio sources are less than about 2 arcseconds in size. So if you wanted to study, half the sources, then you need something which is, got the same sort of resolution as an optical telescope, which would mean a telescope at typical frequencies of something 100 kilometers across. You can't make anything that large. But what you can do, using interferometry is put small telescopes spread over that distance and use a technique called aperture synthesis to generate the image finally, and the picture of the source that you want to look at. So that's a technique which we originally used just in single baseline interferometers, and that's only model fitting to get the structures out. But to form an image, you need several telescopes, and Merlin came about because we needed to do that. I guess the Ryle group in Cambridge, Martin Ryle's group, were the first to actually generate images using an interferometer by adding together lots of little telescopes. But that was only over a kilometre or so, perhaps up to a mile. So the way to get a higher resolution, as we say, down at these seconds of arc, is to go to 100 kilometres. If you want to do finer than that, then you need transcontinental baselines, as we call it. We need telescopes which are situated thousands of miles apart, situated all over Europe. And we have a thing called the European VLBI, Very Long Baseline Interferometry Network. VLBI has been done since the late 70s, and it relies on using atomic clocks and high bandwidth recording systems. So we've used tape for years, and now we're using discs. Problem with that technique, you may record data at different telescopes all around the world, but you don't know if it's worked until you try to play all the data back together and bung it through a supercomputer to find out whether you've got the right data on there or not. And quite often you hadn't, because something had gone wrong. reliability was always an issue. But now we push the idea of using real-time VLBI, and I realized, 15 years ago or so, that the internet and the way that the optical fiber links were being used for commercial traffic were getting to the sort of data rates where we would be interested in using them.
So, of course, one of the, I suppose, challenges of doing interferometry in the early days is that you whatever you're looking at, the radio waves from whatever you're looking at, arrive at each telescope at a different time.
Yeah.
And so you've got to somehow correlate that signal between all the telescopes. And if those data are being recorded at a single station, how are they then correlated in one place?
Well, you
nowadays we use the internet and they're all correlated at once, but was it a case of post the data to one place?
Yes, it was, yes. The data was loaded onto aircraft, if you're lucky, or went on a ship and took quite a while to get there. And so it would quite often be 6 months before you could look at the data.
Wow.
Before it got there, particularly some awkward areas.
Which is a significant fraction of a PhD project.
Yes, it is. It's
want to wait
quite a while
to
wait for your data.
To
find that it hadn't worked. And you had to do it again. PhD students always had priority in getting observing time on the system. You're well aware of the time lags. And then it would mean, of course, the data would be played back through this correlator, where the delays, as you talk about, the delays of arriving at different times, would be compensated for. So all the telescopes would be operating simultaneously, of course. I mean, they all had atomic clocks, they knew what the second was, and they're all operating exactly the same time. But the radio waves themselves, of course, travel different distances, and therefore the delays. And these delays are taken account of in the correlator. They have a delay storage in a digital correlator. It's like storing numbers. You put numbers in the store and take them out again when you need them at the right time. So this was all sort of being done digitally. A special purpose hardware was used for a number of years. Now it's mostly their software correlators.
Mm.
Because current general purpose computers, PCs, are fast enough to do this sort of work.
And of course now our Merlin network is now eMerlin.
Yeah.
And it's connected by optical fibre.
So it's optical fibre. The bandwidths there around 30 times what you can get using the general Ethernet and the academic network, for instance. The academic networks, we regularly use 1 gigabit per second, and that's a routine now, and up to 2 gigabits per second occasionally. And we have done tests at 4 gigabits per second.
So, of course, you have
a special link, bandwidth on-demand link we have.
So you have the resolution of a telescope, which is pretty much as big as the separation between the...
Yeah, as big as the Earth, but almost.
Not necessarily the collecting area as big as the telescope.
No. But the sources are strong enough. There are lots of them you can study. Of course, the square kilometre array is pushing the sensitivity up. Square kilometre refers to its total collecting area. Mm. Not its size, it extends over perhaps 100 kilometres or more. Or will do when they build it. Luckily, heavily involved with designing it now.
Well, Ralph, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for joining us on the Jodcast.
Thank you.